House Committee on Revenue for April 13th will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to start with the bill that we carried over from last time. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2361. Mazin?
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, welcome to Monday the 13th.
What is the 13th? Yes.
This bill comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary, it comes here primarily. This has to do with prohibiting the court from charging long-term care ombudsman or disability rights organ a fee for filing objections in a motion. This bill, in essence, is about court fee, and that's why I think it is in front of you, because we don't court fees. However, this bill, in the way that we see it, does not necessarily have a large fiscal or any revenue impact in that sense. But that's what the bill is in front of you.
Okay, and we have one person signed up to speak. This is of great general interest.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junedeff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. I'm sure you're as surprised to see me as I am to be here. Very quick summary of the bill. For many, many years, advocates in the field of disabilities have been discussing issues having to do with guardianships, particularly having to do with the fact that Oregon's a bit unique in the guardianship world, in that if there's a person who's indigent and there's a guardianship slated for them, that person is not entitled to publicly funded representation in the guardianship proceeding. This was a topic of great discussion back in the 90s. It was felt that there wasn't money to pay for those types of lawyers, and so as a compromise, a concept was arrived at in which the long-term care ombudsman would receive petitions for guardianship that involved placement of people in nursing homes, and Disability Rights Oregon would receive petitions having to do with placement of people in psychiatric facilities and developmental disabilities facilities. And our job was to review those petitions, touch base with the people who were being subject to potential guardianships, see if they understood the rules, and wanted any assistance. That's basically it. Over the years, we've done that at no cost to the state, as has the long-term care ombudsman. However, in recent years, we've come into a couple of situations in which courts have requested that we pay filing fees when we notify the court of particular problems. This has not been a frequent occurrence. I would say that we file something in court anywhere from 2 to 5 times a year. A filing fee, when it's requested, is about $250, depending upon where we're filing. So that's the scope of the fiscal situation and why we brought this bill forward to address a cost of a free service that we've been providing to the state for many years.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Benz, please.
Can you share any idea how many times this occurs?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Betts, again, I would say for our agency, it's normally about 2 to 5 times per year. It's never been more than 5 times in a year.
There it is.
And for the long-term care ombudsman, in my conversations with them, they have not had any costs at all.
Yes, please.
The bill calls for the respondent or the protected person. I was trying to recall a situation where the respondent is it. Who is it generally? Is it the family or is it the state? Who is it?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, they use those two terms because they refer to different points in a guardianship proceeding. So if a person does not yet have a guardian, they would be termed a respondent. Mm-hmm. If they already have a guardian and they're seeking some change in the guardianship, then they would be a protected person. Okay.
And then the final question.
Yeah, please.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question, I guess, is what are the courts saying about this, not being able to charge? Are there, not much because we're not here, but have you heard anything?
I haven't heard a thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else here who would like to be heard on House Bill 2361? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2361. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, we'll wait a little bit. Let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2399. Chris is on this one. Okay. Should I open the other one, too?
Christine's on that one. Okay. There were some people testifying.
That's fine. Let's do this one.
Nobody signed up for this one.
Okay. Great.
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Find my way around.
Yeah.
House Bill 2399 was a vehicle that created a task force to look at the issue of low-income taxation and benefits. It was a governor's bill, but there wasn't really any interest in. They kind of had changed direction on that topic. So what we were going to do, I put together a couple of pages to update the committee on some work that's being done on the topic. So in OLIS, under House Bill 2399, is a handout entitled Low Income Taxes and Benefits. It's also up on the screen there. And basically, I was just going to touch on a few things. I have a couple of charts here just on the topic, on this topic, and within, broken out into two categories, the taxes and benefits. And within the taxes, we have three tax credits. There's the earned income tax credit, both the federal and the Oregon. And then there are the Oregon Working Family Child Care and Child Independent Care tax credits, which are both part of the sunset review process. And then on the benefits side, there are a number of benefits program that are touched on here. There's the medical assistance programs, supplemental nutrition assistance programs, SNAP, self-sufficiency programs, which are basically TANF, ERDC, employment-related daycare, and then rental assistance programs. There is an effort going on within the executive branch. There is a work group, a technical work group that is getting together that builds on some information that LRO produced last summer. And if you go down to the next couple of pages, there's an hourly chart here that tries to get at, creates an example of the notion of the benefits cliff and tries to provide some calculations and estimates and some concrete examples on what the benefits cliff might look like. I'm not going to walk through all of this. This information probably looks familiar to you. It was shared with the committee back in December, and it was from last summer. But the point is, these tables right here are the basis for what the work group is doing right now. They've taken this framework and are adding to it and looking at more benefits programs and trying to think about the best way to explain the information and coming up with a number of examples, different family statuses, different number of children, different wage levels, different number of hours worked, really trying to get at what's the best way to share information with the legislature to think about the so-called benefits cliff and to describe it. And it gets pretty complicated because a number of the programs all have different groups to which they serve and the benefits. So in some sense, if you look at any one program, there's a benefits include benefits cliff there. Mm-hmm. And the notion isn't really that complicated. Anytime there's a program that has an eligibility requirement where people are either in or out of the program, then there will be a benefits cliff. There'll be that marginal dollar where they are no longer eligible for benefits. And that can kind of apply to taxes as well, tax credits, depending on how tax credits are structured. And so it's really an attempt to put all those together in some way that makes sense, that is in some way representative. Because once you go down this path of examples, you start to steer away pretty quickly from something that can be extrapolated to the universe. And just even back up on the first page, the number of people that are involved here, just kind of marching down so you have a sense of the number of individuals involved. For the earned income tax credit, there are about 286,000 filers who claim that credit. There are about 27,000 filers who claim the working family child care tax credit, and 41,000 who claim the child independent care tax credit. A lot of people claim both of the child care tax credits as well as the earned income tax credit. Mm-hmm. On the benefits side, and these are numbers of adults, for medical assistance programs, about 380,000 adults. For SNAP, about 655,000. For TANF, about 125,000. And then ERDC, about 8,100. And then rental assistance programs, you have about 53,000 households. And a lot of these can vary by locality. So really, the first two pages, again, just the base work for the foundation for the work that this other group is doing. And that group includes a number of people from DHS, OHA, employment, I think, is involved. And then I've been participating in the group, and a couple of people from LFO have been participating in the group as well. And the work there is nearly done, and there's talk of how to present that information to the legislature probably within the next week or so.
I have a question.
Yeah, Representative Whitson.
So if you're the recipient of several of these, so you might get SNAP and TANF and rental assistance, are you sent a form by the state, you know, like a W-2 or something, or are these people self-reporting? I mean, are they coming to you and saying, we're getting this money, or are you sending things out saying this is a cumulative, what you're getting from the state of Oregon as income, essentially, or equivalent?
Representative Woodson, generally speaking, the income received under these programs is not taxable.
Okay.
So there's not a direct link to tax returns per se. And so one of the challenges in describing this information is you have these different bins of information. People apply to this program or that program, however DHS operates, and I'm not really qualified to talk about the inner workings of DHS. But all of that is separate from the Department of Revenue and the tax returns that they file. Generally speaking, public assistance is not taxable, so none of this makes it on the tax returns. So one of the challenges in trying to provide how all this information fits together, we're kind of forced to go down an example path. So if we assume that, for example, in this table, there's an adult with two children, mm-hmm. and they are at such and such an income level, then we can say, well, this is what their taxes are, and applicability for the EIC would be automatic. But child care expenses, it depends on if the children are in child care. So then we have to assume that they're in child care. We have to make some assumptions about the cost of that child care. And that applies to all of the other benefits programs as well, assuming that they fit into it or that they're eligible for them. And given the number of adults that are eligible for these programs, for example, there are only about 8,000 people who are eligible for ERDC, which I label child care here. So we're not talking about a large number of people. But if the issue is trying to understand a benefits cliff, we're kind of forced to go down this example path.
So,
please, yeah.
Do you do this yourself? I mean, you take these people and then you go and you look up all this information on each one of them that's a recipient to determine what they're getting, like credits or...
What's the method you're
yeah.
using?
Yeah. For the work here, which was really just a first step in this issue, because it doesn't include medical benefits, which is arguably the largest and the broadest of the programs, basically create a fictional family, mm-hmm. and assign an income level, and then assume that they're eligible for the program SNAP. there are, look at the program requirements for that, and then figure out to what extent my hypothetical family could receive SNAP benefits if they were eligible. And that's really the attempt here. So the calculation here showed that at the 910 wage level, this family of three received $312 in SNAP benefits. But if their wage increased to 1010, those SNAP benefits would decrease to 249. I don't know if that's just a blur to me up there. I don't know if anybody else can read it. And so it's really just phasing down. So it's all assumption driven.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things about incidents also. So, Chris, you had said that only 8,100 families, is it that that's all that qualifies, or that's all that we funded employee-related daycare at?
All that we fund, I believe.
Okay. So it's not that there are only 8,100 families that are qualified. It's that we own there may be 81,000 qualified, but we only fund $8,100 worth, or 8,100 families worth.
Correct. At the risk of speaking out of turn, because I'm not a budget expert, but at being involved in some of these discussions, I believe it's on the order of 20% of the eligible people receive ERDC, just as a benchmark. So it's the point being a small percentage of those who could actually receive them.
Now, is this based on that only 20% apply for it, or that we only have money for 20%?
I believe it's the latter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And if I may do a brief follow-up, and I guess that was another part of another thing, and thank you so much for doing this, because it's complicated to explain, let alone to actually do the work. So thank you, and I know you're working with a number of other members and committees on this as well. I think really another key thing is to think about the overlap, but B, how much of this on those in those numbers are that's the number who claim them versus the numbers that could claim them. You know, so 27,000 the working family child care tax credit, again, if that were 20% as well, there could be 120,000 families that qualify for it, but we only fund it to that level. And so I guess that trying to get to a question there, it's trying to kind of figure out which of these numbers are that's how many there are because that's how many families there are. I think the most explicit, like the medical assistance program, obviously, or not obviously, but so that's how many qualify and therefore use it. Same with SNAP. You qualify because it's a federal entitlement. You qualify, you get it. Versus the employee-related daycare that we talked about. And so I was curious on the tax ones, which of the other, of those two smaller numbers, whether those are because that's all we funded at, or those are that's all the people that apply for it.
Representative Smith Warner, on the tax side with these, there's not the concept of funding it per se. There's not a budget per se with these. Some tax credits, there is a budget where there's a certification process and so forth. With these tax credits, if you're eligible, you claim it, you get it. Okay. One of the differences here, the Working Family Child Care Credit is phased out. They're both phased out as income. The technical aspects are different, but they're both phased out. One of the differences is the Child and Dependent Care Credit is not refundable, whereas the Working Family Child Care Credit is refundable. Mm-hmm. And with throughout the accounting community, if you will, and a lot of the work that the Department of Revenue does, they try to advertise all of this information because it's all part of the tax system. So they're not advertising these credits per se, but it is part of the tax system. Now, you can have people who are eligible for the Child and Dependent Care Credit who don't have enough income, whose income is small enough that they're not required to file. So if I'm not required to file, then I'm not going to claim that credit because there's no point, versus the Working Family Child Care Credit, which is refundable. So presumably that the refundability creates an incentive for people to file and get a refund even if they don't have enough taxable income to actually owe taxes regardless of the credits.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Vince, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chris, thank you for all your work on this. It's just really amazing.
It sure is.
One thing that would be of some additional help would be to carry over to the right on the draft information the amount we're actually spending in those areas.
Page one.
Page one. But my question really is, I notice on page one under benefits, the first bullet point is medical assistance programs, and I couldn't find that on the the next page. Is that not on there, or am I just not reading it correctly?
It is not on there. Now, this work goes back to last summer, and this was just a first step in terms of trying to get our hands around what this looks like, what's the best way to convey the information. And with the work that the work group is doing right now, that does include the medical benefits. So the work that should be presented to the legislature within the next week or week and a half will be broader than this. This is just the first step, and this is being built on to include all of the other programs. And there are a number of every program has its own complexities, and invariably a number of assumptions have to be made. For medical benefits, you have different phase outs for the adults and for the children, or eligibility criteria for the adults and the children. And then premiums can depend on the age of the person. So within this discussion, we need to incorporate assumptions around age.
Follow up.
Please, yeah.
So one of the things that we have asked repeatedly over the years on this, and I don't know how to get at it, but was the concept that this is a status in people's lives that they are passing through as opposed to staying in for a long period of time. Is there any way that the data can show us the repetitive use of these programs? In other words, because part of the concept was that this would be something that folks could work their way through on up the ladder and on out of this space. Is there some way of knowing if someone's in this space for 30 years at a time or three?
Representative Benz, I'm not sure of the answer to that question. That really is kind of a DHS question, and the group hasn't gotten to that aspect of this project, if you will, yet. With tax returns, I do know we have enough information where we could put together kind of a time series. So on the tax side, we can kind of get there. It depends on how long they've lived in Oregon. We only have Oregon tax return information. On the benefits program, I do know in talking with various program folks, there's kind of a churning, and people are in and out of this, the different programs. So even then, it complicates the question of, well, what do you mean by participation? Are they in it every other year? Are they in it for a few months at a time? And some of the programs, they may be eligible, and then they can stay eligible for a year, and the eligibility can come and go. So the churning aspect can be, it's the correct question to ask. It's a challenging one to answer.
Last question.
Yes,
for a moment.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question of incorrect use of the program comes up frequently. Is any of the work that's being done focusing on that aspect of it?
Right now, the work group is just focusing on this notion of a benefits cliff and where and when they exist.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Thank you. So, Chris, can you help me with reading the on page two, the taxes information? Is this looking at the tax refunds that people are getting on some of those? Is that why it's the lower income, there's higher numbers for the taxes than as you go across?
Yes, the number for the tax numbers, they are a bit counterintuitive. The positive numbers represent income to the people, mm-hmm. or the person, the family. So negative numbers represent an income loss, mm-hmm. so tax paid. So the federal EIC, so the federal income tax, just walking down at the 910, the first column there, their federal income tax is $167. And they get the federal EIC, so they actually get $479. And FICA, those are the payroll taxes, they owe $121. Mm-hmm. And then the Oregon income tax, they still owe $31. And of that, they're getting a refundable credit of $321 for the working family and $38 for the EIC.
Okay. Follow up?
Yes.
And so when is this... you know, that they're getting, is this what they're expected to get, or is this the expectation that they would be getting this, seeing this, you know, at the end of the year, if they get a refund versus on a monthly basis?
In all likelihood, it would be April 15th,
okay.
to be a little bit
Like tomorrow.
Precise, yeah, tomorrow. They'll be looking for their
Wednesday,
check.
Wednesday, not till Wednesday.
Oh, no, Wednesday, you're right, yeah.
Wednesday.
Yeah. That's an important distinction, isn't it?
It would be once a year. Taxpayers do have the ability to adjust their withholding. They can adjust their withholding exemptions. And that definition of exemption is different from the personal exemptions that show up on the return. So taxpayers do have the ability to adjust their withholding on a monthly or weekly basis. So there's the possibility that they could be sophisticated enough to figure that out. Mm-hmm. Having said that, the vast majority of taxpayers want a refund on April 15th. They don't want to talk with or deal with either the Department of Revenue or the IRS. So they will just make sure that they get a refund on those dates. Mm-hmm. So it's unlikely that they're going to fine-tune their withholding so that they get it in their weekly or monthly paychecks. So it's more likely that they get it on April 15th, so to speak.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much, Chris, for your work on this. Continuing that line of questioning, are there any Oregon credits or credits in other states comparable to the earned income credit or the working families that are refundable on a monthly basis? Do we know, have any jurisdictions implemented that we know of?
I don't know offhand with respect to other states. At the federal level, there was an advanced EIC for a while.
There was.
The program ended, and I think basically it wasn't used very much. Just due to the complicated nature of the tax returns and the uncertainty of not knowing, well, yeah, it'd be great if I could get this in my monthly check, but I don't want to get into a box.
Follow up.
Yes, please.
Of course, the one large monthly refundable tax credit is the healthcare tax credit on the federal level, because that is technically the premiums paid by the federal government are based on an estimate that doesn't actually become final until we file your taxes the following year. If I understand it correct.
I believe that's correct. I'm still familiarizing myself with that credit, and that's another reason the medical piece wasn't in given all the changes occurring at the federal level.
Thank you.
Representative Whitsett.
So on TANF, it's zero all the way across.
Because it works.
So is that saying that you could actually earn that much hourly wage and it's still zero? Okay. And I have another question on TANF. It was my understanding from another committee, and maybe I'm wrong, but that there are two classes of TANF. One is for a family, but another is that, you know, it's limited to 60 months for a family to be on TANF. But a child, until they're 18, can be on TANF the entire time, receive TANF funds. And I was wondering if, when you figure out TANF, how you, the child's TANF funds are different than the family TANF funds, because you can spend 18 years receiving TANF, basically. And does that then go to the parent, the application of the total income to the parent if the child is receiving 18 years of TANF? Do you know?
Representative Whitsett, I don't know the details, although that does touch, it kind of relates to Representative Bence's question, and one of the elements that's absent from this analysis is kind of the value of time. This is a snapshot for a given year, and TANF, as I understand it, once somebody is working at minimum wage works 16 hours, then they're no longer eligible for TANF. And so it shows up as zeros here because of the assumption at the top line there. It's assumed that these people are working, that this person is working 40 hours a week. So that's why TANF shows up as zero across the board here. And there are a number of programs where people can be, there is this element of for how many years or how many months they can be eligible for the program. That's a different dimension to the topic right here.
Okay. I'd just like to say if that's the case and you have children receiving 18 years worth of TANF, and you might have two or three children in a family receiving that, and it isn't being considered as part of the total income of the family unit. I mean, there's a huge loophole right there. that I was just wondering how we're going to address that. I mean, that TAF is very complicated, as I understand it, with the fact that children can be on it for all these years, but do we count that? And if there's several children in the family, you know, how do we address that?
One of the challenges, and getting back to the work group that's refining this information, is how to incorporate TANF, because once you get up to halftime, the TANF benefits go to zero. Perhaps an analogy might be on the medical side, where the eligibility for the adults ends at an earlier, I think, 133% FPL, whereas the children are eligible up to 300% FPL. So there, the work that the group is doing tries to incorporate that difference.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? We haven't got anyone signed up to be heard on this bill. You want to continue?
Well,
I'm sorry. I didn't let you finish your report. Please, go ahead.
There are just two more charts. The next one right here is kind of a cliffside for the tax. These are the child care tax credits, and these are the effective tax credit percentages for the working family child care credit and the child and dependent care credit. The red line is the working family child care credit, and there's a minimum amount of earned income to be eligible for that tax credit. So that's why it's flat and then jumps up to 40%. The middle piece in there has to do with the income groups, and that's kind of on average within that income group. Some people will get it and some people won't. And then it stays at 40%, and then once it hits 200% of FPL, it starts to step down, and that's what those on the right-hand side. And the blue is the child and dependent care credit, and the same kind of pattern where it steps up as tax liability increases enough for claimants to actually use the credit. At the low end, they're eligible for the credit, but they can't use it because they don't have sufficient tax liability. So these are two individual policies that get meshed in together for that whole benefits cliff, and you'll be seeing more information from this as part of JTAX. And then the last graph I just threw in there, I think will look familiar to members. It's the EIC phase in, plateau, and phase out of the credit. And this is about as smooth as it gets for an increasing credit as income increases and then staying flat for a period of income and then phasing out at a fairly smooth rate. Okay. So just a couple of...
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Just on the household of size 3, is that one parent, two children, two parents, one child?
The household size 3 doesn't matter. It's the poverty levels established by the federal government are for the household size, not the participants within the household.
Okay.
One presumes we have at least one child in that household,
yes,
given the definition. Other questions? I would simply note this stuff gets very complicated very fast, partly because of the way we're organized. I mean, it overlaps with this committee. It overlaps with several policy committees and with the Ways and Means Committee. In order to get the total package right, it requires cooperation among all of those different players. And in a busy session, that's pretty hard to pull. So I applaud the people who are involved in the work groups working on this, trying to figure it out, and Chris trying hard to work in areas where normally the Legislative Revenue Office doesn't need to work because it's somebody else's job. But we don't have any choice about it if we're going to include tax issues in with benefit issues of other kinds. Anything else on this? Okay, well, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2399, and we'll go to the work sessions while I have the whole committee here. Colleagues will open a work session on House Bill 2165, and Paul's going to introduce that. But while he's coming, let me simply say that the point of this one is to get bills with the correct relating clause to the tax credit committee so they have something to operate on. Paul, you want to say some other things?
Okay. yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. The relating clause for 2165 is tax expenditures. And the way the Joint Tax Committee has operated before is it tends to bundle some of the different credits together into a single bill. And this will give you flexibility to proceed in the manner you have in the past.
Thank you. Representative Vance?
Chair, move House Bill 2165 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2165 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so adopted, and the bill goes to tax credits. Paul, we'll open the close the work session on House Bill 2165 and open the work session on House Bill 2093. Paul?
Mr. Chair, same story with House Bill 2093 and the same relating clause. This will give you flexibility to work with the various credits you'll have, and we're up to 15 different bills now in the Joint Committee, so we anticipate probably 20 to 25 bills in that committee.
And that's assuming that we don't send any.
That's correct.
Any substantive bills?
Yeah, right? Any additional bills.
Any additional bills. Representative Bentz?
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2093 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Thank you. Representative Bentz moves House Bill 2093 without recommendation to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits. Is there discussion? Any objections to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2093 and open a work session on House Bill 2127. And Kyle is coming. Perhaps you can bring us up to date and discuss the amendments as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2127, you'll remember this was a bill that came to us from the assessors, and we do have, we discussed the Dash 1 amendment, but we do have the Dash 2 amendment in OLIS, and we also have the paperwork. I can get into that in just a second. But just as a very brief refresher of what the bill did prior to the amendments, it's really about the effect of taxes going from when property is transferred from a taxable owner to a tax-exempt government owner. We had instances, and the assessors gave testimony to this regard, of where when the property is transferred, if the taxes aren't paid, once the property is in the hands of an exempt government owner, it's very difficult. The tax collector can't foreclose on the property and collect through the sale of the property. So a lot of times we see, or in a few cases, we see outstanding taxes that are just collecting interest because they're unable to really be collected upon. So there's a few changes, or in the bill, what it would do is it provides a few mechanisms where hopefully the taxes, the idea is to solve that issue and have these taxes paid. So what the Dash 2 relates to is really this, during the transfer, an authorized agent, whether it be the escrow agent or perhaps a lawyer, when they're making the transfer of the sale from a taxable owner to a tax-exempt owner, the previous language had requirements of that authorized agent to collect those taxes. In the Dash 2, there's some changes made that the authorized agent now is not required to collect those taxes, and in fact they only or it's not even it's been changed from a shall, it is a may now. At the request of the taxable owner, they could have the authorized agent then collect the taxes at that point, but even then it's still a may. There's no requirement for the authorized agent to do that. So that's really what the Dash 2 is, changing some of the requirement language for the authorized agent. The backstops, if you will, in the bill where the sale cannot be recorded at the county clerk's office without a certificate from the county assessor saying the taxes haven't been paid, that's still in there. The change in the lien, making it a lien on the taxable owner, not following the property into the tax exempt owner, that language is still there. And that's why if you're looking at OLIS, the revenue impact for the Dash 2 amendment is still the same as what was in the Dash 1. There's still the components in the bill we think that would increase the collection of these taxes going forward as they occur. Just a note on the revenue impact, it does show, this is similar to a bill we had earlier, more of a steady increase in collections. Really, from the data that we've received, it is more of probably instances of large properties every so often, every few years, so you're less likely to see a steady 1.6 million, 1.8 million each biennium, but rather a couple million maybe once every few years. But it's just been averaged for the revenue impact. And a note on that too, it's not a bill, this is not a bill that is going to raise revenue. It doesn't change the underlying taxes that are being imposed. It's just really create another collection mechanism available for the tax collectors. And the fiscal is minimal.
Thank you. I noticed the assessors are here. Do you want to be heard?
If you have questions, please.
All right. Let's talk about questions. And now, we're talking about the Dash 2, aren't we? All right. So let's assume we're talking about the Dash 2. Are there questions? that people have at this stage? Representative Davis.
I'd just like to extend my great thanks to the Assessors Association, working with the Oregon Land Title Association and the Bar to come up with the Dash 2s, which I'm very thankful for their quick and very good work.
Thank you. Well, in that sense, then, Representative Davis, do you have a motion for us on the Dash 2s?
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2127.
Thank you. Representative Davis moves the Dash 2 amendments on House Bill 2127. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it is so ordered. Do you want to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2127 with the Dash 2 amendments as adopted to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Davis moves House Bill 2127 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion carries. Representative Davis? Representative Davis will carry the bill, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2127. And we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2156.
Thanks. Good job.
Thank you, Sal. Nicely done. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2156 would make the exemption credit refundable for people with federal taxable income less than a certain amount. The measure has a blank there for the amount of income that would be the cutoff for this. And also, the measure also would reduce itemized deductions by a given percentage if income exceeds a certain amount. So the taxpayer would pay the lesser of the itemized deductions or have the greater of the itemized deductions or the standard deduction would have that reduced for their Oregon taxes. And this would reduce that itemized deduction amount. And that's if someone's federal taxable income goes over. Again, an undetermined amount.
We have a list. We have it. Okay. Thank you. Questions for Christine? Thank you. Let's hear from Steve Robinson. Marcia Kelly, please. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Robinson. I'm principal analyst and consultant for Decision Metrics in Eugene. The personal exemption credit is number 1.456 in your tax expenditure report, with a total revenue impact of about $1.15 billion for the next biennium. It is quite simply a transfer of about $195 per year from the general fund to Oregon taxpayers on a per capita basis. I call it per capita because the credit is allowed for every member of the household, whether a newborn or a senior. The only taxpayers not receiving this credit are about the top 3% of adjusted gross income taxpayers, and importantly, those whose incomes are so low that the nominal credit is larger than the personal income taxes they would otherwise owe. I suggested this bill to the Revenue Committee because it seemed to me unfair that the state should deny this per capita benefit to people simply because they are too low income. That seems like backwards reasoning. Making the credit refundable would advance at least three very beneficial goals. First, it would put more money into the pockets of people at the very bottom of the income scale, helping to reduce both poverty and the regressivity of Oregon's state and local tax system. Second, that additional income would be spent immediately, providing the most efficient economic stimulus imaginable to the local economy. And third, it would encourage very low-income people to file tax returns, which in turn would increase our base of knowledge about this segment of the population. We'd be able to have a better understanding of the challenges that group of people face. We don't yet have a revenue impact for the bill as written, But after conferring with certain people who know about such things, I'm confident that it's in the range of $40 to $60 million a biennium. I know that may be a heavy lift in view of your $14 million budget for all sunsetting or new tax credits this session. Especially if you don't want to use the itemized deduction as an offset to this. That's just one way to pay for it. I would suggest another method of paying for it as an alternative, and it would be a very simple amendment to this to make this a revenue neutral bill, and that would be just to suspend the inflationary adjustment of the personal exemption credit for the next biennium. That would be enough to save the necessary amount. There's yet another benefit to having a refundable personal exemption credit, which is that it gives you an easy tool to make other per capita rebates to Oregonians as the need may arise. For example, you will soon have to decide how to allocate the kicker rebate to Oregon taxpayers during the 2015 tax year. While the kicker is in the Constitution, the precise mechanism of how to implement it from time to time is left up to the legislature. I hope we can have the discussion of the best way to implement that kicker rebate, and that part of that discussion will be about how to make the most effective stimulus to the Oregon economy possible. The kicker arises out of the state's collection of income taxes from all taxpayers. The law says, for better or worse, that you must pay out, let's say, $400 million of those taxes next year, but it doesn't say how. To my mind, there's no better way to do it than to give an equal amount to all Oregonians. That's by far the most efficient method in terms of benefit to the economy. There's also an argument that it is at least as fair as any other method, since once you pay taxes to the state, there's no longer a connection between you and the taxes that you paid. It's now the state's money to be allocated however the legislature decides. I hope you decide to make it a per capita rebate, and having a refundable personal exemption credit would make that very easy to do. I know that the bill as it's now written is probably not ready for prime time, but I hope that that it can serve as a vehicle for discussions about per capita rebates and the kicker and other helpful things as time goes along. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Bernhardt, members of the
you'll
committee.
You'll note that we did save you some time today.
Yes, and I have very little to say today. Thank you for that reminder. Chair Bernhardt and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly with the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. And philosophically endorsing the bill to make the deduction refundable. Mr. Robinson said most everything that can be said. I will point out that when people receive tax benefits, refundable tax benefits in their very low income, that stays in the community in the form of necessities, tires for the car, food for the kids, clothes for the kids, versus a lot of tax expenditures that go away to corporate profits. So on this tax expenditure, I'm endorsing it.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? I want to make certain that I understand how this mechanism would work. And I probably should understand it already, but I'm afraid that I don't. Could you describe again how the issue involving itemized deductions interacts with the issue I do understand, which is making this credit refundable?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the itemized deduction part of this was drafted last summer and before much of the debate around different tax methods and revenue reform and so forth was put forward. I am no longer really strongly in favor of using itemized deductions in this particular way. So I would, from my money, I would divorce that mechanism from this particular bill. But the way it would work, if you wanted to adopt this bill as is, you would simply say that let's say you determine that it's going to cost $50 million for the biennium. You would look at the projection of itemized deductions, the cost thereof for next biennium, and say, okay, we're going to reduce that by $50 million. by giving itemized deductions a haircut of that percentage. And that would be a very, very small percentage, maybe 1% or a fraction of a percent, but it would still be, you know, you just put on your on the tax form, what are your itemized deductions, multiply that by 99.2%, and that's what you get.
Okay. So let me make, again, follow up on line 5 of page 2, there's a blank. I'm assuming the number that goes in there to accomplish what you want is a number that would capture that all taxpayers whose credit under this provision is currently less than the total amount of the credit. I mean, who can now claim less than the total amount of the credit because their taxes are less than that?
You're talking about the relationship to the federal taxable income?
Yes.
Again, I'm not sure why that's there. That's not something that was part of my original concept. I think it would be,
simply make it refundable.
I would simply make it refundable and not tie it to any other criteria.
So that if the maximum credit is $200, I make up a number, and my tax liability is $150,
I get $50 back.
I'll get $50 back and not pay any taxes that
right.
year. Okay. Thank you. Representative Bence, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know why you've withdrawn from this particular approach to allocating money to those who may need it, but this device seems flawed in the sense that the underlying assumption is that if you're not paying taxes, you're in need. And one wonders, whenever one looks at, I do anyway, when we look at these different systems, you kind of go, So just maybe hoping that you have moved away from this particular foundation as the device for determining need. Because I know a lot of folks that have an awful lot of stuff, they don't pay any tax. And they don't have any income to speak up, but they got a lot of stuff. So I'm just wondering why we would make those kinds of assumptions. Is there some better way to do it than this?
Well, excuse me, Representative Bence, Mr. Chair, taxable income is one of the very few criteria that we use to determine our policy. If there's a better criterion to use, then let's use it. I think if you look at the personal income tax statistics as I have, the number of people who have lots of resources and pay no taxes because they have big capital losses or business losses or farm losses or whatever, that's a pretty small segment of the population. So I don't think we would be giving these per capita rebates to a whole lot of people who don't have the need. There's nothing perfect about any mechanism. You know, you're always going to be, you know, if you're giving government largesse to members of the population based on some criterion, some people are going to quote deserve it and other people are not going to quote deserve it. So I don't know of a better way to calibrate it.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Anyone else like to be heard today on House Bill 2156? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2156. Paul, we're finished, aren't we? Colleagues, I want you to note you have 43 minutes.
We're not here in the next
committee.
Well, we did that first.
Oh, okay, great.
All done. You're getting 42 minutes of time back that you can now use for other things. And with that, the committee is adjourned.